Our next case is United States v. Navarro-Aguirre. Major Johnson, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Major Barris, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Very well then, please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Frederick Johnson, and I, along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Alan Abrams, represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Leo Navarro-Aguirre. Chief Judge Olson, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Airman First Class Navarro-Aguirre had a valid, lawful prescription for Ambien when he used it on October 1st, 2021. This immutable fact leads to two problems with the findings from his court-martial. First, his conviction for wrongful use of Ambien is legally insufficient because no rational fact finder could find beyond a reasonable doubt that his use was wrongful. Second, his guilty plea to reckless driving is improvident because evidence of known Ambien side effects gave rise to inconsistencies that the court failed to resolve. Use of a substance is wrongful when that use is without legal justification or authorization. But the prescription that Airman Navarro-Aguirre had for Ambien provided just that legal authorization. As the prescribing provider testified at his court-martial, because he had that authorization, that legal justification for using Ambien, the government had the burden of showing how his use went beyond that justification, how it exceeded his authorization. And the evidence at trial simply failed to do that, to the point that no rational fact finder could have found that his use went beyond that authorization. The government offers only inferences to help meet this burden. And while with the legal sufficiency standard, this court should draw all inferences in favor of the government, those must be reasonable inferences. The court can only draw reasonable inferences. And the inferences promoted by the government are not reasonable. This is particularly true when considered within the context of the evidence about the side effects of Ambien use. Evidence presented at trial showed that when a person uses Ambien, they can engage in complex sleep behaviors, including things like sleep driving. The warnings that accompany this prescription are clear that a person using it, even lawfully using it, may engage in activities when they don't know what they're doing. And in the context of that, the inferences that the government is asking this court to draw become all the more unreasonable. Airman Navarro-Aguirre was free to use the Ambien at the time he did. He had completed his shift for the day, as his supervisor testified, and he had no reason to expect that he wouldn't be able to get a full night's sleep at that point. So as he testified, as he told the court, he went home, took his Ambien, and fell asleep in his bed.
But the counsel, question.
Yes, Your Honor.
That testimony, that little snippet right there, came out during the providency hearing on the reckless driving. So because it was part of the care inquiry, did those facts go before the finder of fact on the wrongful use, which was contested?
Those facts were not before the panel, Your Honor.
Okay.
This court can still consider those facts because they are evidence presented at trial. And under the standard in Article 66 for considering the entire record, it is fair for this court to look at those. But it may not be necessary because even without those facts, the government's evidence fails to meet its burden of showing beyond a reasonable doubt that this use was wrongful. And the context of those side effects of Ambien use also give rise to the inconsistencies that create a problem for the providence of his guilty plea to reckless driving.
Counsel, before we do that, can we just talk a little bit more about the legal sufficiency? Government basically says that rational fact finder could have concluded that appellant did not use Ambien to sleep through the night. much of that evidence is pretty thin, like there was a prescription in the car, he was in his uniform, and so forth. But let's just talk about the fact that he took it at about 1800. Now, that doesn't prove, maybe factually sufficient to my mind or other people's mind, that he wasn't going to sleep through the night, but isn't it a fact that a rational person could look at and say, I don't think he was taking it to go to bed at night, and so therefore it was wrongful? I mean, it's some evidence in the record, just the time of day that he took it, that, or the time of evening that he took it, that it just seems implausible that he was taking it to go to bed. Now, we can argue that, oh, don't be convinced by that. That's not very convincing. But that's not really the standard for legal sufficiency. The standard is, could somebody rationally make that decision?
Not rationally, Your Honor, not reasonably, which is the standard that this court has to apply. The provider in this case specifically testified before the panel that a person could take Ambien at any time of the day. She gave examples of how people who work different shifts may need to take it at different times, and ultimately told the court that taking it at a particular time, even taking it longer before the person intends to go to bed than is recommended, would not invalidate the prescription or take it outside the bounds of legal use. And Airman Navarro-Aguirre here, it's clear that he was finished with his duty for the day. He had finished his shift sometime before he took it. And at that point, there's no evidence that he had any reason to need to be anywhere or any other commitments. So he could have taken it and been prepared to sleep for a full night. That's especially true in the context of his testimony that he hadn't slept in almost 2 days. It really makes sense when viewed in that context that he would want to go home and immediately go to sleep, vice waiting for what some might consider a more traditional bedtime. So,
but those arguments really go to, you shouldn't believe that. You shouldn't make that inference, as opposed to you couldn't make that inference.
They go to both, Your Honor. Certainly they go to you shouldn't make the inference, but I think they go to you can't make the inference as well, because it's just not reasonable to infer that a person is wrongfully using their prescription because of the way they choose to use it, when the provider who gave that prescription herself testifies that using it in that manner would not go beyond the prescription, that would still be a valid use for medical purposes. To infer otherwise against that, while perhaps conceivable, is not reasonable and it's not rational. And that's why it doesn't even meet that low bar for legal sufficiency.
Major Johnson, picking up where Judge Maggs kind of left off with you, what about this other factual issue of these inhalants that were, or these aerosol cans that were found in his car or seen in his car? Now, I have to admit, I don't come from a generation where I understand what people do with that stuff. I'll admit that. So, but the members of the panel or the trier of fact in this case might have been more well-versed in that than I am. But what is that all about? And why, as Judge Maggs say, why couldn't the members or the trier of fact consider that on the issue of the wrongfulness?
Considering that, Your Honor, in the way that the government...
Well, first you can tell me what this issue with these cans or these aerosols is all about.
The issue with the aerosols, there were pictures in evidence, they're included in the joint appendix, that showed some aerosol cans in the car. I'll note that those pictures were taken approximately 75 days after the incident itself.
And I'm not asking you to, speak disparagingly about your client at all, but what is the government's accusation as it relates to these aerosol cans?
The government's position, Your Honor, seems to be that he was using aerosols to get high, to somehow affect his state of mind at the same time, and that would suggest that he was also doing the same with his prescribed Ambien. The issue with that is that inference is not only unreasonable, it's impermissible. The two, even if we assume for the sake of argument that both occurred in reasonably close in time to each other, the two would be different acts. They'd be discrete things. And the question about unlawful use of Ambien is, at the time he took it, Was he doing it for some purpose other than the authorized purpose? Even if once he did that, he may then use aerosols for an improper purpose. He might do it while he doesn't know what he's doing because he's under the influence of his prescription drug. But whatever happens then, that doesn't mean that his purpose when he took the Ambien was unlawful. Mm-hmm. And to infer otherwise is really using it as impermissible character evidence. It would be saying, well, we know that he has a purpose to abuse substances, as seen with these aerosols. Therefore, he must have had the same purpose when he used his Ambien. That's character evidence, and that's something that the fact finder in this court can't infer.
Well, is the government trying to say that he was doing both at the same time, or?
Really?
I'll ask them when they get up there, so you don't have to speak for them if you choose not to.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the best I can say is that really as far as the evidence goes is they're suggesting that he must have used them somewhat close in time because he was found in the car having used the Ambien and with the aerosol cans there as well. Even that evidence doesn't say that they were at the same time, and there's no evidence that really goes that far. Evidence about the side effects of Ambien use also gave rise to inconsistencies that created a problem for the providence of Airman Navarro-Aguirre's guilty plea to reckless driving. And those inconsistencies are both with the mens rea of the offense and the actus reus. This court in United States versus Torres held that a person cannot be held culpable for what are essentially actions that are not voluntary. It's the defense of automatism. And the court-martial recognized that automatism defense when it saw evidence of the side effects of lawful Ambien use. So much so that the military judge correctly reopened the care inquiry to address this. The problem that is now before the court is that when the military judge reopened that care inquiry, he did not resolve those inconsistencies. Airman Navarro-Aguirre's testimony during the second care inquiry simply recounted actions that he infers he did based on evidence, but not...
Counsel, the government points to two specific things that he said. He said, when my memory kicks in, it didn't feel like I was waking up from being asleep. And then the judge asks if he was asleep, and he says, no. And then the judge says, do we need any further questions? And both counsels say no. I mean, the automatism defense is essentially I was sleep driving. I wasn't doing it. It was whatever was doing it. Why wasn't that enough to, given that Ambien's a sleep medication, for him to say, I didn't think I was sleeping, didn't feel like I was sleeping, I wasn't sleeping?
Because Airman Navarro-Aguirre wasn't in a position, Your Honor, to recognize the difference between sleeping and the side effects of Ambien. It's called sleep driving, that's how it's referred, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it would feel exactly the same as sleeping. This was his first time using it, the record is clear on that, and without prior experience, it's not clear how Airman Navarro-Aguirre could know what sleep driving, what the side effects of Ambien feel like. And so it may not feel exactly like sleep, but that still doesn't show how his actions were voluntary. And it also doesn't show how he could have had the state of mind to culpably disregard the action or the risks to others from his actions, which is the standard for reckless conduct.
Now, Major Johnson, how do you reconcile your position with this court's decision from 2007 in Jones? Now, in your brief, initial brief, and your reply brief, you don't reference Jones. But there it says, quote, if an accused is personally convinced of his guilt based upon an assessment of the government's evidence, his inability to recall the specific facts underlying his offense without assistance does not preclude his guilty plea from being provident. How are you distinguishing that holding from Jones in this case?
Your Honor, the difference there is that Airman Navarro-Aguirre wasn't just convinced of facts by the government. He was attempting to plead guilty to something that requires a particular state of mind, and while he was in a position that he couldn't be voluntarily acting, or at least that there's evidence that, that his actions may not have been voluntary. And so there's a distinction between being able to be convinced that you committed certain actions or that you did certain things based on the government's evidence, and being able to infer a state of mind or a culpable position. And that's the distinction that, that really matters here. Airman Navarro-Aguirre could look at the government's evidence and see what it appears that he did, the actions it appeared he took, but the government's evidence couldn't help him to see what state of mind he had or whether those actions were voluntary.
So in this type of case, then no accused could ever plead guilty. Would never be provident, would never be able to obtain the benefits of a guilty plea. That person would always have to go to trial, take his chances or her chances.
It would be very difficult, Your Honor, under these circumstances, for someone to meet the high bar that's set by U.S. v. CARE to ensure provident guilty pleas. And there may be some particular facts that would allow that to happen, but without that, this is a situation where the benefit of preventing people from pleading guilty when they can't know their state of mind, they can't know whether their actions were voluntary, seems to outweigh the benefit that they could get from the guilty plea. And because this court has previously set such a high bar for guilty pleas in the military justice system, meeting the standards of U.S. v. CARE sometimes requires that a person, even if they want to plead guilty, is not able to do so, simply because the requirements can't be met under the particular circumstances.
Would the result be the same in your mind if the accused was blackout drunk?
It could be, Your Honor. And blackout drunk is perhaps a more difficult situation because a person who is blackout may not have the same side effects as someone who is using a prescription drug that is known to cause people to do something they don't remember. And there's also the sort of time that it takes for someone to get in that position. But it, certainly if a person couldn't remember their state of mind or their actions because of blackout, they could find themselves in the same position.
So was Jones wrongly decided, or are you saying this is a different beast than Jones?
Your Honor, I do see my time is expired.
Please respond.
Thank you. I think this is a different situation than Jones. It's not that Jones was wrongly decided. There are many cases where an accused who can't remember what happens nevertheless is able to successfully plead guilty because reviewing the government's evidence tells them what they did. What the court's holding in this case can do is simply distinguish a subset of cases where, because of the particular requirements of the offense, and also because of the particular circumstances under which it arose, it's not possible or it's extremely difficult for a simple review of the government's evidence to allow the accused to know that he not only did the actions that were required, but that he was culpable when he did those. And when that culpability can't be established, that would be the subset of cases where a guilty plea really can't be provident.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you,
Johnson. Major Barrows.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court, I am Major Vanessa Barrows, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. Appellant used Ambien for an unlawful purpose, so his conviction for wrongful use was legally sufficient. Appellant voluntarily drove his vehicle while driving recklessly, so his plea was provident. Moving on to the first issue of legal sufficiency. Appellant's Ambien use was wrongful because when you stack all the evidence, it tells the following story. Appellant took Ambien in the afternoon while he was still in uniform, huffed some chemical spray, went for a drug-fueled joyride. These are not the actions of someone who was taking Ambien to fall asleep.
So let's break that down into its component parts. Let's have a conversation about these reasonable inferences. We've got an accused who was legally prescribed the Ambien. He says hadn't slept for 2 days, essentially. It's a Friday afternoon. He's done with the duty day. There's no requirement that the sleep be done at night. It's clear from the testimony. Can take it, people on swing shifts or so forth. Why, in your view, is it reasonable to infer that this person who is suffering from insomnia in the afternoon of a Friday afternoon wouldn't say, I haven't taken Ambien before. I'm going to take it, see if it knocks me out. If it knocks me out until tomorrow morning at 0800, great. So where do we get the reasonable inference that merely the fact that he took it before 1800 hours means that he was abusing it?
Your Honor, I have two responses. First, we can only consider the evidence that was admitted at trial, and that is clear through this Court's precedent in Bethea and Beattie. So some of the facts that Your Honor mentioned was stated in the care inquiry, and we cannot consider that when I move further in this discussion. Second, regarding the inferences, I have three key inferences that will help guide this Court to prove that appellant's use was wrongful. First, appellant was not sleeping. He was, in fact, driving in the afternoon with his uniform
but
on.
But you're assuming too much there. We know from the record that Ambien can cause some people in some certain circumstances to be out driving. And his whole point is the Ambien maybe do it. You're saying, no, he was out driving and then took the Ambien. But that's kind of the heart of the question here. So you're assuming from the outset that he was already driving. Where are we getting that from?
Your Honor, the issue of whether appellant was sleep driving is not relevant to whether he used Ambien wrongfully. And so appellant could have used Ambien lawfully, slept drive, or he could have used it wrongfully and slept drive. So it's not relevant to this Court's analysis. What's relevant is
but you seem to be saying the mere fact that he was driving under the influence of Ambien means that it was wrongful. That seemed to be the approach you were taking just now.
Your Honor, if I expand, the evidence shows that he was awake and he was driving. There was even a witness testimony that explained that when he saw appellant in his car, that he appeared high. He was swaying back and forth. He was smiling.
But you seem to be assuming that sleep driving means, like with the cartoons, with the X's over the eyes, and there's no connection to reality. Sleep driving by its very nature means the person, this is where the whole automatism issue comes in, the doing these facts without being aware of it. So are you saying that in order to be sleep driving that the person had to be conked out? And how does one drive a vehicle? How does one engage in sleep driving if one is completely asleep, as we typically understand being asleep?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. And in viewing like your hypotheticals, that's if you were to view the evidence in light most favorable to appellant, but that's not the standard here. The standard is viewing the evidence in light most favorable to the prosecution.
Granted, but I'm trying to get to why you think these are reasonable inferences.
They're reasonable, Your Honor, because it shows that appellant was awake and that he was using Ambien for an unlawful purpose. If you look at his admissions.
This is a circular argument. You're saying, well, he wasn't sleep driving because he was driving.
Your Honor, but there's further inferences that are rational.
Okay, let's go back, though, to kind of the fundamental points that you're making at the outset and in your brief. Why does the fact that he took it before 1800, why should this Court draw the reasonable inference that that meant he took it at that time to abuse it?
There was expert testimony that explained that you typically take Ambien 7 to 8 hours before you intend to wake up.
And why do we have any evidence in here that says that the accused here didn't fully intend to on a Friday evening when he doesn't have any duty coming up, that he wasn't thinking to himself, God, I hope this Ambien knocks me out for at least 7 or 8 hours. That would be nirvana to me.
It could be a possibility, Your Honor, but in light most favorable to the government, when you connect the fact that he used Ambien early in the day in conjunction with the fact that he was still in uniform.
Okay, let's talk about that, because you talk about uniform. Again, this is someone who has not taken Ambien before. It is sometime before 1800 on a Friday. He's presumably not sure how this is going to affect him. Was he supposed to get in his jammies, in the government's view, in order to say, okay, this indicates that he took it correctly as compared to him thinking, okay, I'm going to take off my blouse, I'm going to relax. If it conks me out, it conks me out. Don't know. Maybe it'll be one of these things where I start to feel drowsy and then I'll get into my jammies then.
Not necessarily, Your Honor, but again, you know, I urge the court to look at all the evidence and stack them up together. And once you do that, it is rational for a fact finder to find appellant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Yes, he was in his uniform, he was driving, but he also admitted to using aerosol inhalants. He was huffing some spray in his car in a witness.
And what happened with those charges?
He was acquitted of those charges, Your Honor. However,
he was acquitted of those charges.
However, defendants are acquitted of offenses and not facts. And to the extent that facts are relevant
to
the charge.
So, wait a minute. So you're taking the position, believe him when he says he inhaled the inhalants, but don't believe him when he says he took the Ambien at his own house or apartment and wanted to go to sleep. So we're supposed to believe him at some times when the government finds that beneficial and not believe him at other times.
What this court should do is look at what was presented during the contested findings. And the fact that appellant took Ambien when he was at home, that was stated in the care inquiry. And this court cannot consider what was stated in the care inquiry to then either find a conviction either legally or sufficient or insufficient.
Okay. The other thing you raised in your brief is there was this brown bag that appeared to be the typical type of bag that one would get from a pharmacist, plus what the government refers to as prescription label. I think most people would refer to it as prescription literature. Number one, this is taken 2.5 months afterwards?
Yes,
Your Honor. And also, in terms of drawing reasonable inferences, don't a lot of people, when they walk out of a pharmacy, go in and to their car, rip open the bag and say, did they give me the right stuff? And number two is, now, I get rushed through the doctor's office or the physician's assistant or the nurse. I want to see, when can I take this stuff? Why does the mere fact that the brown bag and the prescription literature is in the car, we're not talking about the actual bottle of pills. Why should that cause the court to say there's a reasonable inference that he took it while he was driving?
Your Honor, because this inference, it provides context to appellant's intent that afternoon, that he took Ambien while he was also huffing some canned spray. And the expert testified that you can abuse Ambien while also using it with another drug. So that was clear on the record. So when you're taking these inferences and stacking them up together, it goes to appellant's motive that afternoon, that his motive was not to fall asleep. And it's apparent by the evidence. And viewed in light most favorable to the government, a reasonable fact finder could find that appellant's use was wrongful. It was not used for the reason why the doctor prescribed it, to sleep through the night. And so
it wasn't to sleep through the night. It was to sleep for 7 to 8 hours.
Yes, Your Honor. But even with that, the evidence showed that it wasn't appellant's intent to just sleep for 7 to 8 hours. He was found awake, abusing other drugs. He admitted to the responding officer that he was huffing. He was still in his uniform. All this taken together showed that he was not taking it for its intended purpose, to sleep.
But to go back to the point, when you're saying he's found later, his point is, I was sleep driving, which is a recognized side effect of Ambien. So the mere fact that he's sleep driving, let me ask it this way. Would you agree that someone could take Ambien completely correctly, completely in accordance with the doctor's or the physician assistant's or nurse's directions and find themselves sleep driving?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But in looking at all the inferences, stacking them up together, although circumstantial, you can stack up evidence to ultimately conclude a fact at issue. And the fact at issue in this case was whether appellant's use was wrongful. And it was wrongful. And for these reasons, we asked this court to find appellant's drug use legally sufficient. Moving on to the second point of the guilty plea. Appellant's plea was provident because when the military judge asked appellant if he was operating the vehicle voluntarily, appellant said yes. Appellant's statement negated any concerns of automatism. And now on appeal, appellant contends that his actions were the result of sleep driving. But as this court mentioned in Johnson, this court has declined an appellant's invitation to speculate post-trial as to the existence of facts which might invalidate a plea. And this court should do so here. Appellant failed to show that his use of Ambien resulted him in sleep driving. Thus, he provided no substantial basis in law and fact to question his plea. And with this in mind, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in accepting the plea.
Counsel, I understood appellant to say that appellant's counsel to say that his client didn't really have a basis for knowing what his state of mind was. That, I mean, he may have said it didn't feel like sleeping, but he didn't have a basis for understanding what that would be. It was his first time he ever used Ambien. That further inquiry was necessary, and maybe it would be impossible for him to have the knowledge to plead guilty in this case. What's your response to that specific argument? So, I mean, he said it didn't feel like sleeping. The counsel says, yeah, but he didn't know what sleep driving feels like. He'd never had it before.
Correct. He may have not have known what sleep driving felt like, but appellant's statements clarify for the military judge that he did act voluntarily. So he mentioned that he felt dazed, groggy, and slow. Mm-hmm. He also stated that it didn't feel like he was waking up from sleep. It felt more like he just wasn't storing what was going on. Kind of feels like blacking out from drinking alcohol and like a slideshow was there with slides missing. And this court should not be concerned for the lack of memory because, as Your Honor mentioned in Jones, we allow accused to plead guilty without having recollection of the events, but so long as they are convinced that they are guilty based on the assessing the government's evidence, that is sufficient. And this court and its predecessor has never concluded that a lack of memory simply invalidates a plea. And here, the military judge did not abuse his discretion because he ensured that appellant had the requisite actus reus and mens rea to commit the crime.
So along those lines, I'd just be interested in the government's position in terms of what would we do with someone who is blackout drunk if we were to accept the approach taken by appellant on the provenance of his guilty plea to reckless driving in this case?
Can you repeat the question, Your Honor?
Sure. In light of Jones, if we were to take the approach that appellant urges us to take in this case, would Jones still stand? What would we do with individuals who are blackout drunk? Would people who are blackout drunk be able to plead guilty to offenses?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree under Jones that accused that are blackout drunk, if they review the evidence against them and they are convinced that they are guilty, then they, in fact, can plead guilty. And so appellant doesn't raise any persuasive arguments as to why Jones is inartfully drafted. Jones still stands, and many CCAs have relied on Jones and to find guilty pleas provident when there is a lack of memory. And even prefacing the issue in Jones, in that case, it was a higher requisite mens rea than what we're dealing here, and yet that plea was still provident. An appellant told the military judge that, yes, I have a culpable disregard for the safety of others. Appellant knew from assessing witness statements that he was, in fact, driving recklessly. He was swerving in and out of lanes, driving on top of sidewalks. And so those statements there provide the necessary facts to provide a factual predicate to prove that he had the intent. And so with this said, appellant provided no substantial basis to question the plea. The mere fact that the military judge reopened the care inquiry should not give this court concerns. It proved that the military judge knew and understood the law. He understood that there was some evidence of automatism, and he wanted to clarify with the accused that his acts were voluntary. We could not ask more from the military judge in this instance. And when appellant admitted that he voluntarily controlled the vehicle, that made it very easy for the military judge to accept appellant's plea. Barring any questions, may I briefly conclude?
Any questions? I see none. Did you want to briefly conclude?
Let me ask just one question. Going back to the legal sufficiency, let's suppose that we take the view that the only question is, at the time he took the Ambien, what was his purpose? And that whether he later used drugs or later drove the car or later, that since that all occurred afterwards, we don't look at that. Is it legally sufficient to say that somebody, to infer that somebody wrongfully used drugs, wrongfully used Ambien, just because they took it at a weird time of day?
No, Your Honor, but those are not the facts of what we have in this case.
But I suppose we're unpersuaded by all the other facts, and the only fact that we have that we know is true is he took it at around 1800, and it's an unusual time. Would that be legally sufficient?
Yes, Your Honor, as you mentioned when questioning the appellant, Your Honor specified that it's still some evidence that a rational fact finder could use to make the inference or to make the finding of fact that appellant's use was wrongful.
Does that prompt any further questions? Then if you please briefly conclude.
This court should affirm the lower court's opinion because appellant's use of Ambien was wrongful and appellant provided the factual predicate to prove that he had the requisite actus reus and mens rea to reckless driving, and thus his plea was provident. Thank you.
Thank you, Major Barris. Major Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Drawing reasonable inferences in favor of the government does not mean engaging in supposition. It does not mean viewing the evidence in the government's favor despite all reason. Legal sufficiency review can function to stop the conviction of someone who is not culpable for the crimes of which they were accused, despite perhaps odd facts that could mislead a fact finder. And that's exactly what this court should do here. When it looks at the evidence, it should see that all of the inferences the government asked it to make are unreasonable, and that the conviction for wrongfully using Ambien when Airman Navarro-Aguirre had a prescription to do so cannot stand. He should not stand convicted for something for which he was not criminally culpable. And on the subject of his guilty plea, Jones cites to another case, Magolia, in which there was a stipulation of fact that showed that the accused in that case wasn't just guessing. It presented the facts on which the conviction, the guilty plea, was ultimately based. Here, Airman Navarro-Aguirre, it's clear from his testimony, was just guessing as to what happened. He could see the evidence out there as what he did, but he then tried to guess as to what his state of mind may have been or his culpability may have been in that instance. And guessing is not enough to make a provident guilty plea. We're not asking this court to speculate as to facts that may have existed at the time. It's clear from the record what the side effects of Ambien are. It's not Airman Navarro-Aguirre's burden to prove that he was sleep driving or that he was experiencing those side effects. But what that evidence on the record clearly does is it establishes inconsistencies. And when there are inconsistencies between evidence before the court and what the accused said during his care inquiry, those must be resolved or the guilty plea cannot be accepted. That's what the court failed to do, and it's that error that this court should fix
by setting aside that guilty plea as improvident.
Counsel, what weight do we give? At the end of every care inquiry, the military judge says, counsel for both sides, do you have any other questions? And counsel always says, no. What weight do we give to those answers?
Those answers can deserve some weight, Your Honor, but they should be viewed in the context that they're given. Counsel for both sides in this instance had some interest in seeing this guilty plea go through, and so they want the military judge to accept what the accused is saying. But it's now this Court's role to give that an impartial look and see if the evidence presented before the Court provided for a provident plea, which it did not.
Any further questions? Please briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. This Court should set aside the findings of guilty as to wrongful use of Ambien and dismiss that specification with prejudice, and it should also set aside the finding of guilty for reckless driving because the guilty plea was improvident. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides, and the Court will stand adjourned until further order of the Court.
The Court is adjourned until further order of the Court.